Good evening. It's 5:30, and we will call this meeting to order of the Expanded Budget Committee, the third such session. And we're going to do this enough times until we get it right. And first up is Animal Control, SPCA. They have no OTR. They're on Chapter 5, page 1. And Jim Boudreau is here to talk to us about the SPCA.
Thank you, Mr. Dennis.
You're welcome.
The program's pretty straightforward. We provide spay and neuter services to Tompkins County residents and beyond the borders of Tompkins County for some of our neighboring counties. But specifically, the dollars we ask for from Tompkins County are for cat populations locally through our spay and neuter program, about half of which are owned, the other half are unowned, so they're either owned through members of our community who can't afford to get the work done any other way, or they are free-roaming cats with no owner, where we provide spay and neuter services to help stem animal population issues in the future, but also rabies vaccinations for all of them, which is important for public health. I do not have my 2014 numbers yet, unfortunately. As you can see, the past few years, we've consistently done more. However, we do anticipate that this year we will probably do roughly around the same number, probably not as many as 1560. We're trending a little bit lower this year. We've already had about 626 kittens come through, and adult cats I don't have numbers on currently, but certainly happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Jim. Mike Sigler.
Pretty well. Community response has been really wonderful, so we're doing okay with that.
Mike Lane.
Are we getting more cats, feral cats, for example, or are they holding the same amount?
Yeah, what we've seen, and last year it broke down to about 776 free-roaming and 784 were owned. That was, the free-roaming population was trending down, where the owned population trended up a little bit. We have definitely, since the inception of this program, and specifically even since 2007, seen declining numbers over time. Last year's harsher winter also helped with the free-roaming population, we have a sense, this year. But until our 2014 numbers are complete, it'll be hard to say exactly where we wound up with feral, unowned versus owned animals.
Anyone else? Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for coming down.
Anytime.
The Finance Department, Chapter 4, page 123, no OTR request, and Rick is here, ready to go.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Nice to be able to present our budget to you for next year for the Finance Department. As you can see, our expenditures and revenues have stayed pretty constant for next year. The main thing in expenditures is that there's a slight dip in salaries and wages and the fringe benefits, which have total reduction is around $10,000 on the expenditure side. And it's pretty static compared to this year for the revenues. And the net local cost has gone from $788,000 to $778,000. Our major initiatives for next year include pursuing electronic processing of contracts, bids, proposals, and quotes through a new system, an e-gov system formerly known as Catalog and Commerce. We've done a lot of other business with them as far as doing things electronically. And if you remember from last year, we did have some work that we put on the table for this year, and we're streamlining and working through the contracting portion of what finance has to do with contracting through a smart work program. And so this is one of the goals that we wish to pursue in 2015. The second goal is to continue rolling out the Time Force electronic timesheet input, and that is in tandem with what ITS does with us. The third must that we need to look at for next year involves finding a new location for the auction, since our building down at Human Services will probably not be available, or if it is available, it may be too small. So we'll be looking for ideas and looking for locations for next year's auction. I can tell you that this past year that room was maxed out, so we dare not look for anything smaller or much smaller than what we're accustomed to there. And our fourth goal there is to provide more training sessions for county departments on the proper procedures for purchasing, accounts payable, fixed assets, and budget adjustments. That's a quick look at what we're looking to do next year. Our FTEs are the same, and there are no OTR requests.
Questions for Rick? Will.
Why were the salary costs down a little bit, you said?
There's a couple reasons, and one of them is that we had Dave Squires on board with us last year for about 3 months over and above this year. And we also had, for a short period of time, the soil and water person that was the transitory soil and water manager was on our payroll, for lack of a better place to put them. And that's pretty much the main reasons there.
Okay, thank you. The other thing is one location potentially would be the town of Ithaca, which is available, and I don't know if it would be big enough. But
okay. Take note of that.
Good thought, Will. Anyone else to talk or question for Rick? Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome.
Dooley?
Thank you. In, I think it's Appendix B, there are a couple of acronyms I didn't know, so I'm going to ask you what they are. GFOA.
Government Finance Officers Association. National.
SAMPO.
SAMCO. I believe that's the purchasing SAMCO. That's purchasing, right? Yeah, purchasing organization.
And are the memberships person specific?
The GFOA is not, but it does come in the name of a person. So that's kind of both. It's in tandem. It's both the county and myself as finance director. I believe the others are for individuals. Sam Poe and yes.
Okay. Tell me what premium pay means in your department, please. On the salary schedule, there's premium pay. Is it all longevity? Is it something else?
So I want to introduce, and why I keep looking off camera, the premium pay represents the overtime.
I thought we were told it didn't in an earlier explanation.
Joe.
It doesn't, it's not overtime. Overtime has its separate category. So the premium pay is an umbrella account that includes a lot of things, including shift differential. I think
longevity pay, yeah.
Are in here, looking things at like that are in premium
that's
pay.
That's all it is in this department.
Longevity.
In this department, I don't think, do you have any overtime budgeted in this department? I would doubt it.
Well, this is all premium
Julie,
pay.
I think it's safe to assume that it's longevity. We can certainly double check for you.
I am confused by program names, which don't necessarily appear in the program summary.
Is this a question for Rick or Kevin?
I don't know.
Well.
And what was it again?
There are pages in your section that summarize the programs. And one program is called Accounting and Fiscal Control. This is page 131.
Yes.
Another is called Other Revenues and Payroll and Benefit Management. But if you go look at your individual program pages, program 1362 on page 128, the program is called Tax Advertising Expense. So the summary of programs, the names, don't jibe with the others, and I don't know how to put them together.
Kevin.
It's an interesting situation where there's not a one-to-one correspondence between the functional units that you're seeing, for example, on page 41, section 4130, functional unit 1950, mm-hmm. taxes on county-owned property.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily correspond to a program. So there's two pieces at play, and they don't always line up.
Would there be a? Would it be reasonable to ask to get a written description that could explain to me how they fit together, or is that really a lot of work?
No, we. I'm sorry, Kevin. You were gonna. To build on what Kevin said, the programs, we basically take the main activities within the whole department. We don't look at the divisional break or the unit breakdowns. And we try to look at the main functional programs, and we try to allocate costs like on a cost allocation method based on personnel and all the other expenditures. And we break them into these five major programs. So we allocate the cost in this particular view strictly into the programs that they serve, as if we didn't even have those units set up. And the second question you had was, can we give you a breakdown of how we come up with these numbers? Yeah, there's a spreadsheet that Sharon does, and I'd like to introduce my two supervisors here tonight, Sharon Reagan, who is the accounting manager, and Helen Beach is here from the Treasury side and tax collection, and they're the ones that put most of this budget together. But we can share with you the spreadsheet that generates how we come up with those program numbers. On page 131 and 132.
I'm looking at page 130 now, the taxes on county-owned property that you mentioned. It's all expense. It's no revenue. So I'm wondering why the totals are not negative. I guess I don't understand when things total to a negative and when they don't.
I think that's true. That's true on when you look throughout the whole budget document is that the expenditures are listed first, and then the revenues are listed second, and then that portion there at the bottom represents the net local cost to Tompkins County. So to the extent that expenditures exceed revenues, that number is always going to be positive.
So tax advertising expense is all negative. I understand that. I'm looking on page 129 called, oh, I don't know what it is, expense of tax?
Acquisition of property?
Yeah, tax acquisition of property.
And there it looks as though the revenues are more than the expenditures, but the net is negative.
And I believe this is where we show on that particular unit, 1364. Could you repeat the question?
Well, when I looked at the net for the budgeting unit, it's negative. But it looks to me as though it should be positive because the revenues are higher than the expenses.
Joe, do you want to
just take the opposite? So if it's a negative, it means it is generating more money than it costs. So this is really, when you get to the bottom line, it's a reduction in what we have to levy through the property taxes.
So we have treasurer's fees. We have treasurer's fees in that category that far exceed the expenditures in the program expense.
There was something that's not in here that I wanted to express while you were up here, and that is that there's one person assigned to purchasing, and when that person has to be out for any legitimate reason, nobody covers purchasing. Well, I believe I've been told in the past that there's some cross-training, but purchasing really needs to be kept very separate from anyone who pays bills, and I don't know how that's handled. I'm just looking at the information that's here. I think that it would be very wise to have staff increase in purchasing so that there's always someone who does purchasing available.
Some of this we discussed last year at this time, and I'm glad Sharon's here tonight, because from time to time, they as a staff would put in for that additional request. More oftentimes than not, we, especially in this past year, when we, the exact thing that you talked about did happen, then, that we had the person who is the buyer in the organization was out for a protracted length of time, and it does fall on other staff members, which usually it's Sharon or Donna Shaw who fills in and knows those routines and does that. So there is cross-training already available. Unfortunately, we need probably a bit more cross-training, so it's not going upward to the supervisor or a higher level, but there'll be another staff person at an equal or lower level who can slowly learn those duties. But one of the things that Joe has asked of us to come up with in the next couple of weeks is we're looking very seriously at shared services and consolidated services as we put programs together that we might entertain to do jointly with other government entities. And there's three or four categories in the finance department that we are looking at very seriously. And some of them may not be an easy thing to do, and others may be actually quite approachable. One of the things we're looking at is purchasing and bidding, if we would begin to do that perhaps like a consortium for other government entities. And if that were the case, I've already talked to some of my staff, we would indeed need more people. We probably could use more people, as you suggested now, just as the county alone. But certainly if we branch out and we begin to do this as a shared service with other government entities, that would certainly be a necessity. We're also looking at possibilities in areas such as tax collection, payroll, and there's one or two others that we might be looking at also. But purchasing is one area where we're definitely doing some homework on the shared services side. So I appreciate your comments. Looking forward to coming up with plans in all those different programs.
So is that something that would continue into 2015 as a major initiative, or do you hope to have that finished with this year?
With the shared services? Yeah. Well, we're just starting to scratch the surface on it right now, and I think from Joe's outline is that we have to have concrete plans in place by next year. How does that all work, tie together, Joe?
That's right. We have to have this is to respond to the governor's demand that we have a government efficiency plan. The timeline on that is we need a plan to present by next May or June. Certainly there'll be a lot of legislative involved in that conversation. At this point, we're just beginning to set up a committee within TCOG to take a look at these things. So I don't think it's anything that we would plan to do on the first of next year. In fact, what we would hope to have is kind of an outline of how it would work by the middle part of the year. And then we have time under the tax freeze legislation to actually put it in motion. So we're probably looking more at 2016 before anything could happen.
Okay, thank you. Could I ask that the minutes reflect Rick's comments with respect to additional staff and future? Kathy, did that Get it. Makes sense. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
Loveland, go ahead.
So I fully understand page 131. I get that. I'm still on page 130 and trying to understand that page. And thank you, Dooley, for bringing it up. Taxes on county-owned property. These are taxes that we pay to ourselves. Can somebody explain that to me?
The taxes on county-owned property.
Joe, you want to take a shot? Or
Helen's got the detailed answer. There's a budget item in here for taxes on county-owned property. I think everyone knows that when we have property that we haven't put to a governmental purpose, we're subject to paying a property tax. So I think that's what this is. Specifically, which property this refers to or properties, I don't.
All what? Can you please?
Kevin, turn the microphone on, please.
I'm sorry, it's hard to hear you.
There you go.
There we go.
They're properties that are considered reforestry, so they're for specific purposes, these properties. The county owns them, but it's not because we're going to sell them. They're held for specific reasons. So these are taxes with that. We still get taxes on them for the towns and for the schools. And we have to pay the town and the schools for those.
So this is what we pay.
This is what we pay out, yes. That's our expense to pay on those properties, those taxes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Last question, Dooley.
When we withhold a property from auction and have to pay taxes during the year we're keeping it out of the auction instead of foreclosing, would those taxes also appear in this page?
No, Helen's saying no.
Where would they appear?
Helen, please.
Any properties that we don't sell at the auction, we don't take them off our system. We keep them out there, and they keep generating taxes, but we don't pay them until either we put them in the auction or if the state buys them. So they're not, they're part of the regular tax accounts. They're not in any specific account.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else? Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to my staff.
Both of the staff members. And we have next probation, community justice, chapter 4, page 282. They have OTR 4041. They were covered in the county administrator's budget. And you are on.
Thank you. Probation has a very stable budget. This slide really shows our stability. I think this is reflected in part because for the past 4 years, our state aid has stayed static, stable. There's been no decreases in our state aid for many, many years. We were getting a decrease every year, but for the past 4 years, very stable. Full-time equivalents, we do have an increase in 2015. That's because earlier this year we did have a 0.53 FTE who retired in our front clerical office. And this allowed us the opportunity to look at the functioning of that unit, look at the roles and responsibilities. We utilized Smart Work to help us with that process, and we were able to hire one FTE at a lower title, lower pay, at no extra expense. We were able to manage that within the confines of the budget. Over-target requests supported by the budget. We do have two over-target requests. Our 1% cut was equivalent to about $26,000, and we were able to accommodate some of that cut. But we do have two OTRs. The first priority is for $12,000, and it's in reference to local mileage for probation officers. Probation does not have a fleet of vehicles. We are using our personal vehicles in order to conduct county business. Some of those usages are home contacts, field contacts to employers. Probation officers go to the schools. We go to the jail. We're required to attend court appearances for our probationers. So we do need this budget line to pay for that mileage reimbursement. We are required by OPCA to conduct these visits. This isn't an option. If we didn't conduct these visits, we'd be out of compliance with the rules set forth by OPCA. And I imagine we'd be in jeopardy of our state aid if we weren't in compliance. The second OTR has to do with one-time $6,000. We want to use our certified rollover for this expense. This has to do with mandated training for probation officers. So I think I've mentioned before to you all that it is a requirement that each probation officer receive 21 hours of training annually. OPCA mandates that. It is a requirement, and our state aid is contingent upon reaching that mandate. This particular amount, $6,000, though, has to do with the expectation that we'll have to send two newly hired probation officers to Albany for 3 weeks of fundamentals training, and that's quite an expense to the department. It's almost $3,000 per session. So we hope to use our rollover money for that one-time expense. It's just an added burden for 2015. So any questions about either of those? Okay.
We'll do the questions at the end.
Okay, that's
fine. Just to clarify, That was an either or. Was that what we were saying? Because the one was minus. The $6,000 twice, and it was one as a minus.
Kevin?
We would just be using our rollover for that. Yeah.
Okay. The rollover is shown as a negative amount, so that the net of the $6,000 request and the application of rollover is a zero levy impact.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I just thought I would take a few minutes to review some of the goals for the department. Many of these revolve around our evidence-based practice initiatives. So the first one is to continue our collaboration with the Tompkins County Sheriff's Office in co-leading Thinking for Change to Inmates. We did co-lead a probation officer and a corrections officer who was trained in this curriculum. They co-led a group within the jail to sentenced inmates. It was a unique experience. This is a NIC program. It is designed to reduce recidivism. It has a good usage for our incarcerated inmates. We would like to co-lead another group with the corrections staff. However, the one individual who was trained in this curriculum has since left the department, so now we have to wait for the training to come around again and for additional staff to be identified to attend that training. Our second collaboration, again, is with the Tompkins County Sheriff's Office and bringing Ready, Set, Work to inmates. Again, this is a National Institute of Corrections program. It's designed to develop pre-employment and job readiness skills. Again, a good application for incarcerated inmates to help them prepare for their release. It has a jail a reentry focus. We were scheduled to provide that program to the jail inmates in June. However, we weren't able to do it, and I think it revolves around, first of all, it's a voluntary program on the inmates' part, and secondly, you have to have a group of inmates who can actually participate in the curriculum from beginning to end. So we weren't able to come up with a group who would be able to attend the whole set of trainings before the release. So we hope to try to bring that back to the jail in the future. And our third evidence-based practice was to continue our collaboration with the school districts. We did collaborate with the Dryden School District in providing the second step, student success through prevention. That is also evidence-based, and it was 13 lesson plans revolving around empathy and communication, bullying prevention, emotion management, and substance abuse prevention. I had a family court probation officer work with the school district in identifying those high-risk youth who were at risk of, you know, suspensions in school, discipline in school. And so the effort is through this prevention program to keep kids in school. That's our focus. And keep kids from being suspended and having idle time and maybe furthering their involvement in the justice system. So that was a very successful experience, and we'd like to foster that with other school districts as well. And finally, reviewing our current and explore other alternatives to incarceration programs, and I believe this was accomplished via the Jail Alternatives Task Force. One of the outcomes of being on that task force was the realization that the courts are using weekend jail sentences for defendants. It came to light that it appears that at any one weekend there's approximately 4 inmates who are incarcerated on a weekend jail sentence. And it gave me pause to think that perhaps we could offer an alternative to the courts of a weekend community service sanction instead of a jail sentence. And we anticipate incorporating that into our existing community service program. We'll see how it goes. I plan on rolling this out to the magistrates at a formal training this Saturday at the probation department, and then the judges who don't come, I will follow up individually with them. But I hope that they will use this as an appropriate alternative to a weekend jail sentence that will allow the jail to reduce their board outs. They don't have to hold that bed during the week in anticipation of someone coming in to serve a jail sentence. Thank you.
Questions for the director? Mike Lane, Dooley Kiefer. Leslie.
Hi, Pat. How are we doing with our caseload for our probation officers?
Yeah, we are anywhere between 55 and 60 per PO.
And what does that mean, for state standards and things?
Well, there are no state standards.
There aren't any.
No. APA recommends 1 to 50. The American Probation and Parole Association, their recommendation is 1 PO to 50. So we're slightly above. For our greatest risk and high-risk caseloads, the recommendation is 1 to 25, and we're probably 1 to 30, 1 to 35. So we're a little bit above.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dooley?
I was looking at the contracts that you have, and there's one called Secure Alert.
Yes.
I don't know what that is, but I noticed that it's costing less. Does that mean you don't need it so much?
Secure Alert is our electronic monitoring company that mm-hmm. we utilize. Our numbers are going down a little bit in that. I can't exactly tell you why. We use it as often as we can. One of the reasons why the budget is down in that is because we receive funding from DSS through the STSJP money that pays for our juveniles. So we don't have to budget as much on that line because we're getting reimbursement through DSS for our juvenile use of that.
Thank you.
Loveland.
Hi, Pat. I have a couple of questions for you. I'm actually glad to see the information aid position. I hope that's been working out well.
Very good, yes.
Good. I'm hoping more departments will make use of that. My understanding, I'm not involved in this, is that there is a community group, or members of the community, and Joe, you probably know more about this, working on a reentry program, and it has something to do with our jail, I don't know. So I'm looking at the things that you are looking at accomplishing. Many of them has to do with reentry, go back in the community, and wondering if you are involved with it at all.
Well, I had a meeting today with Shelley Michelle Nunn about receiving a grant to look at reentry. So I am on board with that. I'm willing to help out in any way we can. I went over with her some of the things we're already doing. And, yes, we want to be part of that partnership. I think, is that the one you're referring to specifically?
Yeah.
Yes. So we are on board. Yes.
All right. And then my other question has to do with SWAT.
Yes.
It exists now,
yes.
Only not the weekend portion of it.
It does exist on the weekends.
So now it exists on the weekends.
It has always existed on the weekends.
Yes. Okay.
So what we hope to do is to accommodate those weekend jail sentences into our normal weekend shifts. Yes.
Now, there used to also be another program. I think it's the RICS program.
Yes.
Does that still exist?
No.
Can you tell me what it was and why it no longer exists?
Okay. So RICS stands for Reduced Incarceration Community Service. So I'll try to explain it. All right. So in lieu of the court sentencing defendants to a longer period of incarceration, they would sentence the individual to a shorter term and mandate that they do community service along with that. So we used to have in our department a third work project supervisor. So right now I have two full-time. We used to have three. And his primary function was going up to the jail and taking those people sentenced to RICS out of the jail, take them to the community service work site that he had picked, and then return them to the jail at the end of the day. So they would still be in jail, sleeping there, but they would be allowed by, you know, the sheriff would allow us to have that person in our custody during the day doing their community service. Basically what happened is that the courts were not utilizing this often enough, and it really wasn't paying for itself when you looked at the price of the salary and the fringes compared to the number of jail days it was being saved. It wasn't cost effective. Now, is that something we could take a look at again? Yes. And I think that was one of the outcomes of the task force, was to kind of explore that again. And so I see that coming up on future agendas. Absolutely.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else? Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Next up is emergency response. Chapter 4, page 105, 1 OTR, number 15, and it was covered in the county administrator's budget. And Lee is here.
Oh, great.
Thank you, Jim. You won't see any surprises in this budget request tonight. I think you've seen pretty much all of it the last few years running. I guess if we were to term it in any manner, it would be a maintenance of effort for the operations and systems that we have in place. I want to talk technology, and I'm having problems with the technology here. The recommended budget, base target budget, reflected a 1% decrease, as all others are, and this was absorbed through some positions within the operations. We were able to take advantage of some changes in hours with staff that is transitioning toward retirement, and able to account for the $18,000. Major influences in the budget, and some of these I just placed in here as cautions for years moving forward. As I stated, this year we'll be able to maintain effort within the target requests, and hopefully with the one over target that we'll talk about in a few minutes. But we continue to have staffing challenges in the department, and I think a lot of that is generational in nature. We've had a number of retirements take place. We've had a number of long-term disabilities where we didn't used to have those. We've had several each year running for the last 3 or 4 years and continue to have those. Those drive our overtime situations. We're also experiencing new staffing with the communication center manager that came on board this year, as well as the quality assurance position that you created through the budget last year. And with the changes that we've had with dispatchers retiring, others moving on and moving out of state, We've had consistently 3 to 4 to 5 dispatchers in training throughout the last 2 years. What that does is, in order to maintain minimal staffing levels, it requires us to use overtime and work dispatchers in backfilling positions while we bring others up to speed. Training is no easy initiative for us. It takes 500 to 600 hours on average when we put a new employee into a training program. So those have been challenges that we've been dealing with. I think that we're at a stable point moving forward. Initiatives this year, again, we put on board a new professional development coordinator who's implementing new training guidelines and establishing quality assurance processes. And we spent some time last week with the ECRAC Emergency Communications Review and Oversight Committee reviewing those initiatives. Equipment replacement. Last year, we established a line of $12,000 that allows us to at least replace the computers in the offices on a more routine basis. The problem is that we have no other equipment lines within the budget, and we're an equipment-rich department. You've invested over $20 million in the last 6 to 8 years in capital projects for the radio communications system. And those are all pieces of equipment, hundreds of pieces of equipment that over time need to be replaced. So in the long term, and I'm going to talk about how we're able to maintain those now very briefly, but in the long term, we need to be looking at a more secure replacement mechanism for those. We've been successful this year in receiving 2 grants through the State Office of Interoperable and Emergency Communications. IC stands for Interoperable Communications and is allowing us to extend, if you will, the reach of our radio communication system to neighboring counties and also to bring our systems up onto a similar operating platform that our neighboring counties are on with their new radio systems. It will allow us to communicate from system to system and be able to back support their operations and theirs ours, and also access their transmitters that are at the county edges. The PSAP grant, Public Safety Answering Point grant, is an enhancement grant that was put forward this year that will allow us to replace the 911 telephone switch and telephone systems that are 10 years old this year. The good thing about these grants is that they are multi-purpose grants that allow us to replace older pieces of our operating systems. This year we will replace our 10-year-old radio consoles that control the radio telemetry, and the PSAP grant will allow us to replace the 10-year-old telephone switch, which is not capable of the next generation 911 functionalities. Two very major projects, but are a savings in the long term to the county, where we would have been looking for a couple $1 million to replace those in the next few years. Revenues are always a challenge for us. As you know, we rely upon wireless 911 surcharge and landline surcharge of $1 per line in the county. Those number of landlines continue to decrease. They've been offset in increases in the wireless phones, but we know at some point in time there will be a saturation of that market and a limit as to what we can expect to gain in new customers. The other thing is that the landline surcharge at $1 per line will sunset 5 or 6 years down the road, and we will want to be looking toward some type of revenue to replace that. It's unlikely that it would be continued. We have had some success in co-location activities at our tower sites, are continuing to negotiate and explore those opportunities. And I'm pleased to say that the state has this year restored some of the 911 reimbursement monies that were taken out of the previous state's budget in previous years. All those factors together, we remain stable in revenues, but I don't know where we're going to be in the long term as far as being able to expand upon those. Capacity, I just mentioned as I move into the next slide, and that has to do with having enough help to maintain the operations. Our full-time equivalency right now is at 29 employees. Same number we were at 10 years ago. We had lost a position in the technology side several years back. It was restored with last year's budget for our professional development coordinator. The other half-time position is a position funded on one-time money that I'm asking to be continued into 2015 for our interim assistant director for dispatch operations. That over-target request is for $48,000 in one-time money, and it would allow us to keep for one more year the individual that is helping us transition the communications operations. I would point out that as part of the budget, we factor in a fringe benefit rate the same across the board. The individual that is now filling this position does not receive health insurance, has not requested it, is not in this, enrolled in the state retirement program. Your actual cost of this over target request is probably about two-thirds of the $48,000. However, you see that savings come up in the fringe benefit accounts elsewhere. My hope for this position is that we're able to maintain it, and so I can keep my sanity as we implement $3.5 million worth of grants over the next year to get us to the interoperable communications upgrades and to get the phone system replaced. We're working on a number of initiatives, the establishment of the quality assurance, quality improvement programs, accreditation of the 911 center, and also managing the large volumes that continue of calls that continue to transpire through our operations. One of the reasons that we've been able to make the progress that we've made in the last year has been through the hiring of some very, very good individuals who are getting their feet on the ground and implementing the QA, QI training programs, and also that I've had the administrative and operational support to move forward with some major grants and major projects. So I'm asking for one over target request in the year moving ahead. Those are the highlights of the budget, Mr. Dennis.
Question for Lee. Dooley and Mike.
I did not see any memberships listed for your department. Do you not have any? There are no professional organizations anybody has to belong to?
There are some, but we generally pay for them out of our own pockets.
So it's not a county business expense?
Professionally, I pay my own dues to the organizations. I took those out years ago when we were having to try to maintain staffing levels during years of the budget cuts.
I guess I'd be interested to see your list of what you're paying out of pocket, if that were possible.
Okay.
For you and anybody else in the department who's doing that. There's a line on page 108 called rent, and I'm wondering what that's for.
Is that an expense, Dooley?
Yes.
Because there's two rents. There's rent revenues and rent expense. The rent expense would be for land where we lease for tower sites.
Oh. Right. Thank you.
Someone who had their hand up over here. Oh, Mike. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, Lee. A couple of things. You talked about the interoperability grant and the work on that. And I know we've had some issues with some, at least one of the police departments wanting to have better communication with out-of-county police agencies. Are we making any progress there?
Yes, we are. With the interoperable communications grant, there's several major components. One is the replacement of the radio consoles that puts us on a platform where our system will communicate with the other recently implemented systems in Cortland and Cayuga County, soon Seneca County, and eventually the others will come along. It also will allow us to communicate up to the regions, Onondaga, Broome County in particular. Second part of that are microwave links between our systems. So our towers will have a spur that will communicate, will link to the tower system in each of the adjacent counties. And we're taking our loop and expanding it so the loop goes throughout the central New York region. With the console upgrade and that ability to link to the other counties, we can communicate to their individual tower sites and theirs to ours. The third part to it is the implementation of what we call mutual aid radio base stations. And there are nationally licensed frequencies that can be reused throughout all areas of the country for law enforcement, fire, and EMS. We're placing radio base stations and antenna systems at all of our sites and at a number of the adjoining county sites so that when our units leave this county, they can go to a national frequency, which is received by the other county, and either they or we can connect our radio systems at these sites and patch them or bridge them so that they're operating on merged radio frequencies. And the same will occur here. If somebody comes from Cortland County into Tompkins, they will go to a UHF conventional channel. Our dispatchers will pick it up. They will bridge it to an operations channel on our 800 megahertz system, and you'll be able to continue to communicate. And every radio in the county, as a fourth part of this project, will be reprogrammed and calibrated so that these national mutual aid frequencies are in those radios and readily available for use when we cross the county lines. And this is a model that's been developed statewide as part of this interoperable communications grant. And the goal is to have these base stations and these radio frequencies in all of the radio bands that are being used throughout the state, accessible whenever you cross county lines, wherever they may be in the state. It's not a seamless process, but it's a means of extending our radio communications out as we move out of the county. It's a way for us to extend our communications to those that are coming in. And that project is underway with the console upgrade and the microwave linkages, which will take place over the next 6 months, and the base stations thereafter.
So the issue that we were told about, if a Cortland police car is coming through Tompkins to get to Hartford, for example, and needs to communicate with our local sheriff or our local Dryden Village police, they're going to be able to have one radio and be able to talk to that car?
That's their goal, yes. And so the next step will be to bring these counties and consortiums together to develop operational plans so that that can be a smooth process. There will be parts of it that are not automatic. There will be parts where you'll need dispatcher intervention to bridge the frequencies because you just can't possibly monitor every radio frequency all the time. But we set up hailing channels so that dispatch can be immediately notified by anybody coming in or out of the county.
Okay. Thank you. The other issue I wanted to ask about, and that is in the dispatching center. Quite a number of years ago, we combined the county dispatching with the city of Ithaca dispatching. And I believe in that agreement, we agreed that there would be one dedicated person for the city. I wondered if you could tell me just in generalities how that works and how it's been working.
It's
For example, how many people do you have on at a time, and how many are we have one always in that role?
Yeah, the practice was established just 10 years ago this fall when we took on the dispatching duties for the city. And our minimum staffing levels keep us at a minimum of four dispatchers round the clock, one of which is a supervisor, three of whom are handling the call taking and dispatching duties. Typically, there is a supervisor, one person, one dispatcher that is handling fire and emergency medical services calls and receiving the 911 calls as they come in, One position is dedicated to city police dispatching, and one position is assigned to all other agencies, sheriff, state police, village police departments, TC3, and managing outside of the city radio communications for law enforcement. We've maintained that practice consistently since we started. And from a number standpoint, if you look at the volumes of calls, it's almost a third, a third, and a third split. A third of the volume of emergency calls and 911 calls and radio traffic is almost always city police related. They're the largest agency we deal with as far as call volumes. A third is all the other police agencies combined, sheriff and state police and the villages, and sometimes with TC3 and interacting with some of the state agencies that assist us, such as state parks and DEC. And a third is the fire and EMS call volume, about 20,000 calls times three.
Including
the city, yes. The fire and EMS, roughly 5,000 out of 20,000 fire and EMS calls are the city fire department. So 25% of that volume is being handled by the fire and EMS dispatcher. It's worked well. I wouldn't want to go to any lesser staffing levels. You may remember the number of 911 calls that we handled back in the late 90s were about 15,000 on an annualized basis. Today they're over 40,000. It's not that we have that many more incidents, but we've got a lot easier access to telephones, and if an accident occurs out here on the street where we may have had somebody run inside this building and call on a landline, we'll probably get a dozen telephone calls from people on cell phones and smartphones. And it's that need for the number of bodies to be able to answer these calls and manage that information is what makes it imperative that we have the minimal staffing levels that we work with.
Thank you, Lee.
Anyone else? Thank you, Lee. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I ask one quick question? Sorry. Lee, you talked about the revenues that, or the expenses that we pay out, the rent expenses. Do we still get revenues coming in for rent from anyone renting on our towers?
Yeah. Right now we have three tenants at the old public safety building tower, three of the major carriers, and we've been negotiating for one other site with a major carrier, and there's another carrier that has talked with us in the longer term about data services, but that, the industry goes through different cycles, and right now they're in a no-build cycle.
Okay, good. It's good to know it's still happening.
Will?
Thank you. This prompted me to wonder, going way, way back, when we built the towers, we were told that we were going to get considerable reimbursement from the state. That never happened, but is that completely dead, gone, or is it there's still any discussion of that?
No, I think it's a longer term proposition. One of the things about this interoperable communications grant and the base stations I was explaining to Mike and the use of the national mutual aid channels, that actually is the next evolution of the statewide wireless system. They've actually come back to the counties and said how best to approach it, and now they're providing us with the funding so that we can link these systems and create that inter-county regional interoperability. The other thing that is happening is that the state has reestablished their reimbursement grants so that to maintain some of these grant-supported projects, they are going to make money available, amount yet to be determined, but they are looking to provide reimbursement funds to the counties to support these enhancements that they're making with state dollars. Not maybe in the lucrative numbers that we looked at a few years ago, but there is some support, and that is the genesis of the interoperable communications grants that we're seeing. The other thing that I just would point out coming down the line is this nationwide move toward public safety broadband, the FirstNet system. And I know a lot of you know Harlan McEwen, who chairs the Public Safety Advisory Committee for FirstNet and was part of the negotiation of these nationwide frequencies in this nationwide system. And ultimately, I think you will see the state and the federal government leverage all of these communication systems that have been built by the counties and local governments to place the broadband on those systems, use our microwave radio networks. And ultimately, what I'm hopeful for is that our data systems become part of FirstNet, and in return for use of this broadband system, we're able to quit using the private carriers to handle that mobile data traffic and maybe save tens of thousands of dollars on a yearly basis. So a lot of these system enhancements that are coming, I think, fulfill that vision. It may not be that we'll see hard cash, but we may see some sustainment dollars for our systems, as well as some enhancements that come along funded by other entities.
We certainly can help. Thank you, Lee.
Thank you very much, Lee.
You're welcome.
We have next the History Center of Tompkins County. We are on Chapter 5, page 14, two OTRs, 18 and 19. One was covered by the county administrator. One was not.
Good evening. Which of these ones? This one. Good evening. I'm Jean Curry, and I'm the interim director at the History Center. Some of you might know for the second time. And they keep calling me back. I feel like a cleanup batter or something. But anyway, thank you for listening to me this evening. Let me see. Move on. You'll see that we've been recommended to have our funding from the county increased to $105,813. And I just quickly wanted to run through a few things, and when I get to the bottom couple of things, I'll spend a bit more time. I just wanted to remind you briefly about some of the things that the History Center does. Point out that our charter actually has us as the County Historical Society, but we've changed our name to the History Center, as you probably know. The key things that we do are the collection and preservation of county history, the archives. We have an enormous collection of photographs, 100,000 photographs, and lots of three-dimensional objects as well. We do exhibits. Currently, we've got an exhibit for Moog. I hope all of you have learned how to say his name. It's Moog and not Moog. And also right now, a small exhibit about the Erie Canal, and both of those are going to go through next year. Last year, we did exhibits on glass, curiosities, hip-hop, behind the lens, and you can see that there's a wide variety of topics that that we cover. We do a lot of programming that usually is related to the exhibits, but not all of them. They could include music, presentations, book groups, et cetera, et cetera. We do a lot of education. We're a member of the Discovery Trail, and so we participate in Kids Discover the Trail. We also have a lot of homeschoolers coming in, and also K-12 classes as they are requested. And we're very proud of the 8-square schoolhouse out on Hanshaw Road. We have about 1,000 kids coming through the 8-square school. They have a class based in 1892, and the kids all come, if you don't know this, they come dressed up in the right kinds of clothes. They bring their lunch in a lunch pail, and they have an interesting class, which we discover, because we've been doing it since the 1980s, that there are now people who went there back in the 1980s who are now bringing their kids are coming now in the fourth grade. And it's astonishing how many of them look back with great fondness on that class that they had at the 8th Square. They really love it. I should also point out that we did a major restoration and rehabilitation of the 8th Square School during the years 2011 and 2012. And if you didn't know this, that building was built in 1827, but there has been a schoolhouse on that property since 1814. So there's been a schoolhouse on that property for 200 years, and it's been a school. It's never been anything else since then. So we're delighted that we have that as part of what we think of as our education program and also as part of our collection. We have lots of partnerships with various organizations around town. You can read them for yourself. We have diverse sources of funding, private gifts, lots of grants, fees, and government, right from the federal government, state government, and the county government. And this year, there's already been a record number of over 9,500 people that we've served. So I think by the end of the year, we're going to have probably the biggest number of people that we've served ever. So to get to the nitty-gritty of what happens here, the county covers our occupancy, and that covers the rent, utilities, and security for us. There was a time, a long time ago, where the county did give us more money than that, but at some point that got reduced to covering our occupancy. The key things I wanted to let you know about is that, we are looking for a new executive director. The search is underway, and we're now down to four finalists who will be coming in for interviews. The first one comes on the 29th of September, and then we'll have the other three in the first week of October. And we're hoping that out of those four people, there's going to be one excellent person who will be the new director. Then the other key thing is that our lease is going to be up in 2018, and we will more than likely be moving. So that a key issue for us in the next, not just the next 4 years, but really in the next 2 years, will be to identify where we're going to go and then to begin some very serious planning about how we are actually going to move. But I wanted to let you know that the county, through the tourism program, covered the cost of a feasibility study that was done early this year, under the previous director, and that was to look at potential partnerships that might eventually be connected to the move. And out of that, I realized that what we really needed to be doing was a very serious space study. The feasibility of partnerships was one thing, but we've been casually talking about the fact that the History Center has a space currently of about 12,500 square feet. But the big problem is that that's in a building that's got 12-foot ceilings. So we've got collections that are actually up to 10 feet high, and you can't put those into most other buildings that will only be 8 feet high. So the square footage, I think, is not, it is a relevant number, but we really need to be looking at what we actually have in kind of volume. And when you look at our collection, which most of you never get to see because it's kind of, you know, behind the scenes, the shelving is different sizes, the kinds of containers that the collection, particularly the archives and the photographs, are in different sized containers, and so it gets very complicated figuring out exactly how we might move all of that stuff, what I think of as the stuff. And then in addition to that, of course, we need space for exhibits, for programming, for offices, for storage, et cetera, et cetera. There have been some discussions that have been going on behind the scenes with various places and people that I don't really want to get into because none of those are really coming to anything right now. But I'm hoping that by early next year, under a new director, that we really begin to focus on where the History Center might move. And we would need to be moving in 2017. We can't wait till the end of that year. So we really do need to find a location by early of next year and then plan for the moving in 2016-17. And, of course, that will mean lots of fundraising, probably some kind of capital campaign to actually do that. Our over-target request is just really to cover the increases in the cost of our current rent. As I mentioned before, our occupancy covers rent, utilities, security, and insurance. And, of course, the rent is going to go up. The utilities, depending on, you know, the cost of energy and so forth, we share the cost of the utilities with all of the other tenants in our building. So that comes to approximately $10,000 a year. And then we have a security system, which, of course, we have to have because we do have a valuable collection in that building, and then insurance. So that's it, I think, isn't it?
Questions?
Yes.
Do you want to describe the over-target request supported?
Oh, yes, because you don't need that anymore. Right.
No, there was one OTR that was not approved, and I think that's that one. Nope.
That one.
Next one?
Yeah.
Next one.
Oh. This one?
That one.
Right.
It's not funded.
It hasn't been supported, so I guess I'm not really going to speak to it. I mean, we would love to have that extra money if there was enough money in the county budget to do that. We are not adding to the object collection very much, partly because we really don't have the space to put, you know, three-dimensional objects anymore. We do add to our archival collection and the photograph collection, so that increased support for the direct of the person doing the archives would be important and valuable, and we would love to have it if you can see a way to giving it to us. But I guess the county administrator is not going to support it.
Okay, any questions for the interim director? Will, and then Mike, and then Dooley.
So I would encourage you, if you feel strongly about an OTR, that, you know, make the deal. I understand your deference to Joe, but and we have enormous respect. But
all right, well, then I'm making a strong pitch for that.
You know, we'd like to hear. I'm curious, you mentioned the tourism dollars that you got, mm-hmm. I'm wondering to what extent you are marketing yourself or have the ability to market yourself to people outside of to visitors from elsewhere. And do you have any sense of what, of the people who visit, how many people are coming from outside the county?
Yeah. I don't have a good feel for the specific numbers, partly because we don't really ask, you know, as people come, we're free, and so people can just come and go. We don't, and unless we actually talk to them, or if they fill in, we have kind of like a sign-in sheet that people can volunteer to fill in. So we really can't give you the exact numbers. We know that we do get people coming because they would come to do research in the library and reference services for genealogy or, you know, whatever it is that they're coming for. The Moog exhibit did bring in people from outside because anybody who's interested in synthesizers and kind of electronic music have come to that. The tourism money that we got for that was the it's the capital one that comes through TCAD, and we did it was done through
that. That was the study of co-locating with the Wharton Studio. Was that
It was to investigate. It wasn't so much the co-location feasibility, but just partnerships with the Wharton Studio and with the Ithaca Aviation Heritage Foundation.
Right, yeah. Right.
And there was also a section in it about the public library as well. And they're all organisations that we partner with already, but this was another. Slightly more in-depth survey or review to see how much more we could be doing.
Okay. Yeah. And secondly, on the 8th Square Schoolhouse, I'm delighted it continues. My kids thoroughly enjoyed that. How is that funded? Is it fee-based?
There are some of the sort of the regular maintenance of it we just take out of our regular operating budget, but we do get fees for the kids through the Kids Discover the Trail. That's a fee-based thing. And then anything else that happens out there in terms of education is usually there's a fee charged for it. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Mike and then Dooley.
Will touched on what I wanted to touch on.
Okay. Dooley.
Thank you. Could you explain your relation with, if any, with Historic Ithaca?
We are two separate organizations, which I'm sure you understand, with different missions. They are concerned about the built environment, about buildings, landscapes, et cetera, and we are the history of the county, so that we actually, I think people often confuse us and think that we are the same thing, and they often wonder why we're not, why we haven't joined together. But it's partly because we really do have two separate missions. We do partner with them with a lot of programming. And in fact, they are going to be having, I think it's their 50th anniversary either next year or the year after, and they've already contacted us to see if we can't be working together on exhibits and programming for that. So we certainly work together. They refer people to us, we refer people to them, but so far we still are two separate organizations.
And any relationship with the county historian?
The county historian is a kind of a separate thing from the history center. At various times, the director of the history center has been the county historian. I'm not exactly sure when that happened the last time, but I think when Margaret Hobby was the director, she may have been the county historian at one time. The relationship is good. Again, we refer things backwards and forwards. The municipal historians, every town, and the city of Ithaca and the county, they all have historians, and that group of municipal historians meets regularly at the History Center. So we see all of them, and so we do see Carol quite frequently.
I would really appreciate seeing a copy of your full budget by program, and your full staff numbers and full number of volunteers, just so we can see what a small part we are of keeping you going.
Yes, you are right. So the budget, I can send those to you if you'd like. Yeah.
Okay. Anyone else?
I had one. As she's writing stuff down, I wanted to talk a moment more. In reading the summary in our budget book about the History Center, it says the History Center in Tompkins County. Somewhere else we have it referred to as the History Center of Tompkins County, which is correct.
It's the History Center in Tompkins County, and so that is part of our name and it's in.
And that suggests that you could be a History Center of other places too, but you'd be located in Tompkins County. Is that what you meant to convey?
Nope. We are the History Center and Historical Society and Museum. Tompkins County is okay. is our chartered area. Yeah.
One of the things you say you want to do is providing safe and accessible housing. I don't know whether accessible means handicapped accessible or close to the center of the county in the city. So I'm not sure what that meant.
I think it means all of the above, Julie.
Well, when you're looking for other locations, it would be nice if you could stay centrally located.
Yes. I think that the general thinking of the board and most people that we talk to that are sort of connected to us would like us to continue to be as downtown as possible, to be sort of in the center of the action.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Sure. Planning Department is next. Chapter 4, page 270. OTRs 36 through 39. Three were covered in the county administrator's budget. One was not. Ed is here with staff members.
Good evening, everyone.
Hello.
Good evening.
We're probably fresher than you are at this point, but
we're good.
As you can see, our recommended budget differs from year to year. You've seen this over the years because we have, in addition to the normal and ongoing programs we're involved in, we're always engaged in projects and programs with variable funding from outside sources. So in any given year, things can vary quite a bit. But as you'll see, our net, which is the most important thing to focus on for this purpose right now, is going to be down 2.84%. In terms of the overall budget, some of the revenues and expenditures that are there this year that won't be there next year, they're summarized, some of the key ones. The Ludlowville Stormwater Control Project that we have grant for, and a big portion of that will be completed. The Climate Smart Communities with the EPA will be completed this year. And the Farmland Protection Plan update will be substantially complete this year. So those things are all things we're showing in the budget for this year that won't be reflected next year. This is just here for reference, really, but to remind you that we're not only responsible for the programs in the Planning Department budget, but we administer the $2 million in the tourism program budget in the Planning Department. Major influences, as I think you're all aware, we're in the process of working on the update to the County Comprehensive Plan this year. In putting together the scope for that last year, we added sustainability and climate adaptation as things we knew we wanted to include. We also did a survey in late last year, and these were some of the top topics that were indicated from the public in that survey that they would like to see additional emphasis on in the comprehensive plan. So we've tried to provide some information and plan and some direction on healthy and safe communities, for example, affordable living, and looked at some added emphasis on infrastructure issues as well. So those are all things that kind of stretch the capacity of the department a little bit. Full-time equivalents, the target recommended a reduction. We requested what is essentially a maintenance of effort and slight recovery from the reduction in 2014 that was recommended in Joe's budget. So we're a little bit up from that target number. And this is still quite a bit below where we've been historically years past. Our over-target requests were, again, basically maintenance of effort requests. The first one was to maintain staffing levels and not have to reduce hours of staff, which was recommended and by the county administrator. We also asked for continued funding for the Stream Corridor Restoration Program. That's a program that had been funded with three-year funding, which ended this year. It's been funded one form or another in the budget for around 20 years, starting as flood mitigation program, expanding to Stream Corridor, but also including flood mitigation currently. So we had requested that as target since it had been funded for, that's as close to a ongoing program, I guess, as you can get, 20 years in the budget. It was recommended as one time, and we can live with that for the time being. We also requested funding for the energy program. This is funding we use to leverage other funding in the community or from outside the community to work on energy issues. We requested as one time, and that's recommended as one time. That funding has fluctuated and has been higher in some past years when we had some rollover to supplement what we were asking for. One over target that was not recommended at this point was for the housing needs assessment and strategy update. As I think many of you remember, we did the housing needs assessment as a result of the first comprehensive plan in 2004. It was recommended that we look at the housing needs long term and be able to quantify what was needed in the community. That study was completed in 2006, and I think many of you have heard the number 4,000 units plus or minus. That's because that housing needs assessment really gained a lot of credibility in the community and was referenced by many players in the housing sector of our community and became kind of a focal point, really, for efforts to develop more housing. It has, you know, it only went through 2014, and, of course, as the years went on, some people started to question the accuracy, whether all the assumptions were still valid, and it actually ended up being used by some to oppose new housing projects in the community, saying it was too old and out of date. So we think it's important to try to update that, get current numbers, and update it in a way that we can keep it current going forward, that we can understand what are the underlying assumptions so that as those change, we can have some mechanism to modify our estimates or projections. And so that's what we would propose to do if we had the funding, would be to work on a process that would be updatable more easily. And that would also lead to, depending on the results of that assessment, potential updates to our strategy. So that's
questions for Ed and or staff. Go ahead, Dan.
I have a couple.
No, Dan Dooley.
Same initials.
Brian.
I had a question about the county forestry program. It's not something I don't know anything about. Could you tell us something about that?
Yes. Well, we have approximately 400 acres, I believe it is, of county forest land in the county. We did a sustainable management plan for those acreages several years ago. In that plan, there was it called for doing some selective harvests on certain parcels. We've had difficulty getting successful bids on those harvests. We've tried a couple times because of the small size and some of our requirements. People that might be inclined to do a small logging job weren't apparently interested in complying with and bidding on a county project, and so we haven't been able to do that. What we do on a generally, we look for opportunities at this point to see if we can do something. We've talked with DEC about the possibility of trying to piggyback on something they're doing in one of the state forests, and we continue to look for those opportunities to get these harvests done. And so what we put in the budget typically is a revenue and expense. There's some expense in going in and marking the trees. You would expect to get a revenue that would probably more than offset, but we just kind of put in the budget more or less as an offsetting placeholder so that we have the ability to move forward if we get an opportunity to do so.
Thank you. I have another question. Looking at your tourism planning and management lines, and I saw an asterisk up there that you didn't talk about switching the funding from tourism to your main budget. I wonder if you could say a little more about that. When I look at the page on tourism planning and management, your expenditures are going down from $101,000 to $26,000.
Yeah, this is a bookkeeping matter, I guess, or accounting matter that we're still discussing in terms of what we should be doing long term, whether that stands alone, the funding for the primary staff person is kind of standalone in the tourism broad budget, or whether it really should more properly be shown in the planning department with a revenue offsetting, which is, I think, what I hope will eventually happen. But that's what that reflects. We're showing the FTEs in this presentation, but right now the funding is in two places. The funding for the primary staff person is in the tourism program. That other funding supports existing planning staff that support and other expenses that support that tourism planning effort.
Thank you.
Brian.
Thanks, Ed. Mine's on the OTR that's not supported. And by the way, were you here for the last presenter? Because when they're not supported, you can't argue. You have to.
I'm not arguing.
Oh, okay.
I'm just explaining.
You don't even have to talk about it.
I'm curious because I wasn't here for the last needs assessment. What were the recommendations and results of those? What was the cost of that? Sure. And what I would really like to see, and I hear what you're saying, is to develop a system where data can be fed at on an ongoing basis. And I would prefer. I haven't let you answer those other questions yet, but to consider funding of this is to put the horse before the cart and develop that procedure to do that, and then go out and do the study. But go ahead.
Sure. I believe we hired a consultant. You know, it was just a little bit shy of $40,000 when we did this study originally back in 2005 and 2006. We put out an RFP for a consultant, and we hired a consultant. They came in and prepared the complete analysis. They met with us and others in the community to assess the situation. And they came, they provided us with their recommendations and with their quantification of what they saw as the need, and then they left. And so we had a product that was not easily updatable with new information. What we propose to do this time would be to go out for a request for qualifications for a consultant to assist us with developing just what you're talking about. Come in, work with others in the housing community in the county, come up with an approach to projecting housing needs and a mechanism by which that those numbers could be periodically updated with new data to keep them, the projections, current. So we'd be getting not just a end report, but really a product that allows us to continue to monitor and update over time. So it's kind of a hybrid of what you were asking for and what we had done before.
Okay. Thanks.
Dooley.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you about your, I guess it's contracts. You're giving less to Esri, and I wondered why.
I think our fees are just down because we don't have as many licenses as we did have previously. So that's a license fee that you're seeing in their contract with Esri.
So does that mean only a few staff people can use it, or what?
Go ahead.
Actually, the county actually gets a bill for all of its. Esri is the GIS software, our computer mapping software, and the county actually gets one bill for all the licenses throughout the county to ITS, and then the bill is split up among all the departments. Since we don't use the, really only one staff person uses the software that requires the majority of the license fee, we really only sort of pay for one license, and that's changed over time. We used to have more people doing the more sophisticated analysis, and that's now that's primarily one person's job.
I wanted to talk about wetlands.
Okay.
The WRC has a wetlands committee, and there's recently been a report on a pilot project to do the wetlands in Dryden, and it seems as though the results provide the approach being used, which uses aerial photography, among other things, is producing much more accurate information than is available on either the National Wetlands Inventory or on the state DEC inventory. And the Wetlands Committee went to the Park Foundation for a grant to extend the use of this technique countywide. I am not sure whether the results of that grant application are available yet. I've heard rumors and believe that it would be unusual to get the whole amount asked for, but to the extent that the county could supplement that amount, I would like to see that included in the planning department budget. And since you're appearing here tonight, this seemed like the only way to mention it is while you're here. Do you know more about that actual funding?
The last I heard at the last Water Resources Council meeting, which would have been a week ago tonight, they were just going in for their interview or whatever it's called to present their project to the, I guess there's a board that makes that decision.
Okay.
So they haven't heard yet, but I don't know when they are expected to hear.
So that information will be available before we finish our budget deliberations?
Probably.
Yeah. The usefulness of the information can't be denied. When we learned about the Biggs project developer withdrawing, it had to do with the accuracy of wetlands information. So that's an example of where it would have been useful to have it earlier than rather than later. And certainly with all the other environmental things we worry about, wetlands information is very important. So I'm sorry I don't have a dollar figure that I can bring up tonight for colleagues, but that seems really important to me.
Yeah, we were hoping to see some of the results and assess. In fact, I almost wanted them to go out and see what they could tell us from air photos about our property and see if it actually reflected what we found on the ground to assess the accuracy of this methodology before we might recommend investment in it.
Dooley, a suggestion I have about the wetland issue is that as the information becomes available to these people from the grant app, that's a perfect thing to try to do at a voting meeting if, in fact, you wanted to move something like that.
Yes, I just hadn't come up at all, and it seemed like I should at least mention it tonight.
It was Will and then Mike.
Thank you, Jim. So on the stream corridor maintenance, you had said this number has essentially been flat for many years and made sense because it's an ongoing need to just build it into the budget. But if it's been flat for many years, essentially, unless our costs have really gone down, we're actually doing less each year, correct?
Yes.
And is there any way to, I don't have a sense of the magnitude of the problem. Are we systematically, holding our own, or in a perfect world, would we, be able to get ahead of it by putting more, at some point? Or
this program's always been recognized as really only dealing with part of the problem or part of the issue. There are much larger projects and much larger needs than are reflected in the amount of money in this program, and some of those needs have been met through outside funding sources. I mentioned earlier the Ludlowville project, for example, where we identified a serious problem. We were able to get both state and federal grant funds to work with both the town and the county to address that problem. So we've never envisioned that this program would be able to take on the big scale projects like that. But what it can do is it can help define the issue more clearly, like has been done up in Ulysses, where we have a serious erosion problem. We were able to use these fundings to hire a consultant to help us devise and accurately determine the cost of the solution. It's also able to deal with issues where smaller scale issues of erosion that can be dealt with a willing landowner and less intensive techniques. And that's what we really tend to focus on with this, understanding the problem better with these funds and then solving the ones that can be solved with relatively small amounts of money that can often leverage other contributions, either from landowners, from local communities, or just really allowing us to work with landowners to revegetate an area before it becomes a serious problem.
Okay, Brandon, thank you. And secondly, I have a question for Joe on the OTR that you did not recommend. What was your thinking on that?
One, it was simply money. We really hit the outer limits of what we could do. And even though this is one time, we really didn't want to raise our one-time spending above where it had been the year before. So there was kind of a lid on what we were trying to do with the money. The second was we felt that this would be a policy conversation within the legislature, that this is one that maybe the legislature would want to talk about whether or not this warranted funding or not. So we wanted to bring it forward. I think in an OTR that's funded often, it just can get passed without the discussion. We felt that this was one where you might want to have a conversation about whether you felt this warranted some funding.
Thank you.
Mike.
On the housing needs assessment, wouldn't this be something that might be a candidate for grant funding? Might we be able to piggyback on with Cornell and some of the surveying they're doing, or with maybe the old housing fund that they talked about? Wouldn't that be a good candidate to try to get some outside funding for this? Having grown up in Tompkins County, I'm a little bit cynical, thinking that there's always been a housing shortage, and there probably always will be. We know there's a need for affordable housing. But affordable housing is more than just apartments in a dense area. It may be the need for young families who want a house to be able to afford a house and not have to go to Tioga or Cortland or Seneca County to buy that. So I'm just thinking that as probably a good exercise as this might be, I'm wondering if it has to be all county funding and if we can't have it look maybe a little broader.
We can always look for funding. There aren't all that many sources that I can think of off the top of my head that this would potentially even fit into. And, you know, the smaller the amount of money you're talking about, the more time you put in relative to what you benefit you get when you try to go for grant funding. But certainly that could be explored. What I've heard, what we've understood from the folks that are bringing bigger amounts of money into the community for housing is that this is something they've been able to cite with funders, particularly in Albany, is that there's been a local needs assessment done by the community. It shows this need. That reinforces the studies they may do for just their specific project to show that there's been local action to document their needs. So it's certainly useful in getting larger amounts of money. If we didn't get this funding in the budget, we certainly would look for other potential sources if they're out there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Dooley?
I just wanted to weigh in on the, whatever it's called, flood stream protection, flood prevention program. I was at a Water Resources Council Streams Committee meeting this afternoon, and the city is very worried about its flooding, and the question of the source of the sediment that comes down the creeks that plugs up their water dam, but eventually finds its way through the degrading area of the wildflower preserve in the city and eventually into the various creeks that feed the inlet. There's a strong attempt to work with people at Cornell, to work with USGS to get more information about the streams, but this particular effort by the county is absolutely part of what they care about. When you did the Malone and McBroom study, that sort of got us off in a better direction, and a lot of that is still being followed up on. But I can't imagine us dropping this program, and it seems really foolish to have to ask for one-time money every year. I would certainly support making it a regular target, and it could certainly be more than $25,000, but to get it at $25,000 would be a victory, even though that buys less every year.
Dooley, keeping in what I've tried to do for 3 years, is there a question you wanted to ask?
Do you agree, Ed?
We requested it as target, so I'd have to say we agree.
Okay. Anyone else? Thank you very much, Ed.
Thank you.
Up next is the county historian of Tompkins County. And it is on in Chapter 4, page 57, 1 OTR, and it is included in the county historian budget. OTR number 11.
Okay, I didn't crash the system. Thank you for hearing me. I would be happy to answer any questions you have, but I would like to point out two things. One is that the Tompkins County Sesquicentennial Civil War Commemoration Commission, that awful name, has been active, has been performing a drama in each of the towns on the county, and I have brought a list of upcoming events that the Civil War Commission will be putting on for each of you. And I would also like to tell you that the Civil War Commission so far has brought in over $106,000 in scholarship money for nursing students at TC3. We are looking to create a memorial to the Civil War nurses from the county. It should cost approximately $23,000, and we've got $11,000 so far. So the commission has done its best to show its worth.
Let me ask you, is there another slide other than this one?
I don't know. No, this one.
You want to go back to the first one again, please? All of you can note the numbers and the changes. Okay, go ahead.
I have nothing to – I mean, I'd be happy to answer questions. I would like to note I'm not
– Could I just see the second slide, please? And that's your OTR one time, and it was funded in the county administrator's budget. Now, anyone have any questions for the historian? Michael.
Hi, Carol. 2017 is the bicentennial of Tompkins County, and we're coming fast. We will probably want to do something to commemorate that.
I certainly hope so.
And I can't believe we aren't going to need some funding for that. I wondered if you could talk any about whether you've taken any look at that, the kind of money that we might need to ask for, and whether we ought to start putting some money away in the 2015 budget so that we would have some built up for 2017.
You and I have talked about the need to celebrate the county's bicentennial, which was significant, and it certainly brought this county together in 1817. And what we have talked about is finding ways of showing the community how the county has served them and changed over time, both in reaction to state mandates, but also in reaction to the needs of the people in the county. So that I think there is a need to start putting a little money away. I couldn't tell you what, because I think first we need to pull together someone from each of the towns so that we can sit down and talk about what might be possible.
Anyone else? Thank you very much.
I have one more thing to tell you, and that is I am not pushing a new book, but I'd like you to know that on this new book, which I will leave with Mike, there is a county building. There's a picture of the county library when there was graffiti on it. I'm sort of sorry the graffiti went away. It was a good plug for history. Thank you all.
Okay, thank you.
Zen and the Art of Local History, edited by Carol Kamen and Bob Beatty.
But it's our county library.
Tompkins County Area Development. Michael is here. Chapter 5, page 68. No OTRs.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Mike.
Tonight, I'd just like to provide a brief overview and reminder of some of the things that we do, but then focus on some of the challenges we expect in the coming year and how we need to work together to address those. This is the slide that was created by the county, so I have nothing to say about it. This is based on the five-year revenue agreement that was signed last year. So I'll move forward. Here's a reminder of TCAD's revenue model that we've worked so hard to achieve and which really the county took a leadership role in. You can see that prior to 2013 and 14, we were relying way too much on fee-based income from the IDA and LDC. The county established a task force and came up with a recommendation, and really the county was the first one that made the major commitment to economic development and TCAD. That allowed us to engage in a very, very successful employer investment campaign that had a goal of somewhere between $1.2 and $1.4 million. We have a few employers outstanding, but we're approaching $1.8 million. And again, I think the county's leadership in being the first ones in to commit to provide one-third of TCAD's budget was a really powerful, powerful statement that we used over and over again when we were meeting with local and regional employers. So our investment campaign was successful, and we also predict that while fee-based revenue will never be at the levels it's been in the past, it will be at a level to support another third of TCAD's budget through 2018. So our revenue model aspirations were met. We're in great shape. And again, we thank the county for the commitment that it made that approving the recommendation from the task force. Very quickly, just a review of what we say as often as we can, where good jobs come from, mostly expansions of existing businesses and new businesses started by existing entrepreneurs and to some extent business attraction. How we allocate scarce resources, both in terms of incentives, dollars, programs, and staff time. We look at the growth potential of businesses, the wages and benefits that they pay, the range of the type of jobs, particularly looking for companies that will create quality entry-level jobs, commitment of the management team to our community. Does the management team live here? Are they involved in not-for-profits? And also the return on investment. What do we get in return for the amount of time and effort we put into projects? Here's a reminder of some of the major programs we manage, some of which on behalf of the county, the IDA, the Tompkins County Development Corp. And while the Empire Zone program is no longer in existence, in some sense, there's still a very significant administrative burden. We manage about $1.7 million in revolving loan funds. We manage the Tourism Capital Grants Program, and also spend a lot of time trying to help local entrepreneurs and local businesses gain access to regional, state, and federal programs. Some of the initiatives that we've launched over time, and I'll focus on the last one, that's the TCAD Foundation that was recently created. That's a 501c3. TCAD is a 501c6, so this new 501c3 will help us gain national funding in basically two areas, one for entrepreneurship development and another one that's very critical that we've talked about before, workforce development. And these are some of the studies and strategies that we've done over time, and I think it's worth mentioning that if we didn't do this, it would likely fall on your county planning department as a burden. So while you're funding one-third of TCAD, fee-based income, and the private sector is funding the rest, so you get a pretty good return on your investment there. Some of the challenges we see moving forward, and these are challenges not entirely unique to us, particularly with respect to workforce. Communities that are expecting growth and experiencing growth are challenged in attracting high-end engineers and managers to the community, and at the other end of the spectrum, finding entry-level workers that they can train. We also have some unique infrastructure issues in our community. There's a lack of natural gas that no one really was that aware of, but it is could be a real detriment in some of the projects that we're currently working on, and certainly housing projects that we're not involved in but that do need natural gas. We need to begin to develop the next set of shovel-ready sites. Right now we have fully infrastructured acreage. It should last us a couple years, but to put infrastructure into shovel-ready sites can take a long time, and that's something we need to begin now. Flex buildings where growing companies can move into and grow. South Hill Business Campus was a great example of where that was successful. We hope the next generation will be Emerson, but if that falls through, and it could because it's a very complex project, we'll be scrambling to look for an alternative. And then the last challenge we face are mergers and acquisitions, IPOs, initial public offerings. As we see some of our tech-based businesses grow and become successful, we're seeing them acquired. And that results in either ownership that's someplace else in our nation or, in the case of Kionix, ownership that resides in Japan. So we end up losing that direct connection to the owners of businesses, and that's a challenge. To illustrate some of these things that I've characterized as challenges, I'd like to provide a little case study. This is a company that the IDA is considering delivering incentives to, has been around since 2000. The second bullet is what they do. And what that really means is tiny, tiny little lasers that can fit on integrated circuit chips. And so when telecommunication is flowing through fiber optics, it'll get to a box and have to be redirected or amplified. And they've come up with great ways to develop these little reflective laser devices. And it's world-class stuff. They said it couldn't be done, and they're doing it, and they're blowing away the competition. They've attracted over $40 million in venture capital. Some of that venture capital is coming from world-famous venture capitalists. One of them is Draper Fisher Jurvetson from California, who has also invested in companies like SpaceX, eBay, the electric car manufacturer, Tesla. So here in Little Ithaca, we have world-class VCs coming here to invest in our companies, which is a great thing. They bounced along since they were founded in the year 2000 with 5, 10, 15 employees. Now they have 143 employees. And in the next 3 years, if all goes well, they'll add 90 more people here in Tompkins County. Something that was really exciting for us was that they hire unskilled people. And when they hire them, 85% of them are unemployed. So this, the most high-tech business you can imagine is hiring unemployed people, devoting their own resources to training those people to work in a crisp, clean, bright, very exciting environment. And they start off at a pretty decent entry-level wage with superlative benefits, but have a great career ladder. So for us, this is right in our sweet spot. We were less interested in this company when they were just an R&D company, because everyone that worked there had PhDs. Not that there's anything wrong with people with PhDs, but they have the mobility to go any place to get a job. But the fact that now that they're making stuff and selling it internationally and hiring unemployed people and using their own funds to train them is really exciting for us. And these are the kinds of companies we'll hope we'll see more and more of. But going back to challenges, in order for them to succeed, they have to be able to attract super high-end engineers in this very esoteric business they're in, and also find those entry-level workers that are trainable. They'll spend the money training them, but they need to find what they consider to be trainable people, and there's various characteristics of that, and we're working with them, with the Workforce Investment Board and your community college, on pre-screening and things like that that will help them. Right now, they're going to be expanding into existing underutilized buildings in the county, but their next generation, if they continue to grow, will require a new building. And right now, there probably isn't enough natural gas to heat that new building. And that's a huge problem for us. We probably have enough shovel-ready sites for this company, but 2 or 3 years from now, we might not have enough shovel-ready sites for the next generation of companies. Merger and acquisition, this company is getting national and international attention because, again, they have a product that no one else has been able to duplicate because of the technology and the research and development that they have in-house. So they're a prime prospect to be acquired. And that's a good thing in some ways because there's a lot of local investment in this company. So we'll have local people that will get a little bit richer, and they'll end up investing in the next generation of high-tech businesses that will hopefully create good jobs for our community. But we need to do everything we can to meet their needs. So if or when they're acquired, they stay here. And that includes entry-level workers, and that includes the next site that they'll likely need to manufacture their product. And that site is probably in place, but it probably doesn't have enough natural gas capacity, and that's an issue for this company. So I'll leave it at that, and hardly anyone has fallen asleep, and I'd love to answer any questions you might have.
The only thing I would like to say, Mike, before those of us on the IDA have learned about BinOptics, and basically the second dot means an invisible laser, I believe, and don't we all have a drawer full of those at home? But it's at least I'd like to get one at some point. But I think the incredible part of this particular case study Mike gave is that they want to stay here, and it's important that they stay here. And the IDA clearly is of the mindset that we want to try to assist them in any way we can.
And,
go ahead, Mike.
And one, I'm sorry,
yeah,
Mike.
Oh, no.
Just a quick point. One of the interesting things is they've gotten to this point with zero local incentive dollars or zero assistance from the state or federal government. And what they're able to do because of their technology and management team was attract $40 million venture capital. But now it's the local community that needs to step in and provide assistance.
Mike Klein.
Mike, if we could talk about the natural gas issue you just mentioned. We know that in Dryden and Lansing that NYSEG is proposing a natural gas line, a 10-inch line, to increase the capacity that will go to Warren Road and some of this area that you've been talking about, and that there are folks that are not happy with that. Folks of goodwill who I think believe that if we don't have incentives for fossil fuels to sell more fossil fuels, then the companies such as, I don't know, BinOptics or others will simply find another way to power. They'll put in solar arrays or other kinds of things. And that sounds, that's very inviting to say, well, yeah, they could put in an electric array and be able to run this plant. Have you, has TCAD looked at that? Is that a possibility? Or if we say that to them, will they stay?
I don't think it's a possibility for an individual company to do something like that, nor do I think they would want to spend their time and scarce financial assets doing that. They would follow a path of least resistance and have to balance the brain power they have here. I would say that if we can't provide for their needs for more manufacturing space, companies like this would shift manufacturing someplace else, and we'd only be able to retain the research and development. And we've seen that with other high-tech companies. So I certainly believe that we need to be heading as a nation and world towards more renewable energies, but to put that responsibility on the back of a single high-tech company is just not reasonable.
Anyone else? Dave.
Yeah, Mike, do you think proximity to the airport is important for these guys, or just a radius to the airport?
I think, one, having an airport like we have with the service we have and hopefully improving that service is critical to all the employers in our community. Proximity for some of those companies is important, but if you're working with a management team that has lived in Boston or Silicon Valley and they talk about proximity to the airport and might have to drive 20 minutes instead of 4 minutes, they're okay with that. Certainly the land around the airport is prime, and that's where people want to be. But if we have to end up creating a site that is 5 miles away or 10 miles away, I don't think that's going to be an issue. Having the airport, though, is critical. Right. And the service that we currently have, if not better service.
Yeah, my concern was building out in the Warren Road area versus, say, Newfield for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, I think The other issue there is the real estate investment. Most of these companies don't want to own their own real estate, so they would go to a real estate developer and have something built to suit. That real estate developer, even if they have a long-term lease with a high-tech company, is not going to want to build someplace where they might not be able to get another tenant to move in if that high-tech company craters or moves out of town. So that speaks against a much more rural location.
Dooley, you had your hand up?
I did. I'm back on your handout page, which lists some of your studies and strategies.
Mm-hmm.
The last one is the power plant repowering study, which I know you are proud of having done. But in my view, it went against a position that our legislature has been taking. And I feel very uncomfortable having our economic development arm promoting natural gas when we are very concerned about fracking, for example. It seems very peculiar to me. With respect to your saying that Vinoptics or any other high-tech company that you feel really good about needs to heat its building with natural gas, I just got finished reading an article that said that it's a major error to be building things that will be heated with natural gas to the extent that any hydrocarbons are needed for materials use, PVC pipes, whatever. That may be tolerable, but you don't want to use it for heating. The best direction to go now is geothermal heating. I have no idea whether the land near the airport is ripe for that or not, but it seems to me that focusing on natural gas is not wise, particularly after the march that took place this weekend when many people more knowledgeable than I spoke about that. So I'm asking you whether you are willing to look beyond natural gas to other forms of heating, Mike.
My obsession is creating good jobs for local residents that are either unemployed or poorly employed. I don't care how buildings are built, but developers who know how to build buildings and how to make money doing that and doing it successful, well, they're the ones to choose how buildings are heated, lighted. And right now, all the developers in town who are much more experienced at this than I am and have been doing it for decades say they need natural gas.
Well, I guess it would be great if you could help educate them otherwise, but maybe that's our job.
That's not my skill set. I don't have the information to provide to them to change their minds, and that's not my role. And with respect to your comments about the study we did on repowering, that was purely economic development. We're not supporting natural gas or against natural gas. We quantify the economic impact of that plant being repowered with natural gas.
Yes, I have looked at the study, and I hope someone answers it.
Anyone else? Will?
I guess I'd like to gently second Dooley's concern, Michael. I was at a gathering in downtown Ithaca yesterday of people who were basically trying to do a local version of what was happening in New York City around the climate change. And there was one speaker went at great length expressing utter bewilderment that in Tompkins County, we our TCAD was focused on natural gas, and why were we not sort of seeing beyond that? I would point out two stories just from today. The Rockefeller family is divesting from fossil fuels in terms of its charitable foundation. Of course, they built their fortune on that many years ago, but they have seen. And I just, as I was driving to this meeting, heard that in New York City, Mayor de Blasio has proposed a very, very ambitious goal to essentially get the New York City off to a great percentage off fossil fuels. So it's being done elsewhere. I would hope that we could begin to see more of that right here through TCAD.
I guess I'd have to push back on your comment that TCAD is focused on natural gas. TCAD is focused on creating quality employment opportunities for the residents of this county, for those people that are unemployed or underemployed. It's the companies and the developers that are telling us that in order to meet the needs of those companies that will hire those people, they need natural gas. And unless someone provides an alternative to that, I don't know what TCAD can do.
Well, I would hope that we could be part of envisioning that alternative. But
Mike, take
it. I'd like to push back on your comments as well.
Please use your mic, okay?
Sure. I would like to push back on those comments as well, for the simple fact that as I sit here in this wonderfully warm building, also heated with natural gas, it seems like we're demanding something of developers that we're not demanding of ourselves. I mean, if you would like to push forward with resolutions that we convert all of our county buildings to geothermal, then that should be brought forward. But I haven't seen anything that says anything along those lines. So we're demanding of other people something that we're not demanding of ourselves. So.
Will, you have a question?
Well, I think it's a process, Mike. I think we are committed, and all of us are inching forward to a different reality. I mean, clearly, natural gas is the dominant fuel. It's the cheapest. It makes sense economically. But its future is limited. And I think at the county, at all levels, I think, where we have some ability to imagine what are we going to be doing, you know, 10, 15, 20 years in the future, anything we can do now to be preparing makes us better positioned for, you know, vital economies. So once again, my call would be into the mix of thinking and not just start from the assumptions that that's the only way.
Mike Stamm.
One of the things that we do spend quite a bit of time is trying to link our customers and the developers that serve our customers with NYSERDA. NYSERDA has, there's no media here, more money than they know what to do with. It's not a particularly efficient operation, but companies that we've worked with to help connect them with NYSERDA might surprise you, like Therm, which is hundreds of years old and looks old from the outside and the inside, but they've installed solar panels. So we are working with companies to help them access grants from NYSERDA to use energy more efficiently and use different forms of energy. By the way, I'm also chairman of the board of MEGA, Municipal Electric and Gas Alliance, which is pretty aggressively trying to provide municipal governments and other forms of governments with alternative choices beyond the conventional choices. So we are attuned to this, but we struggle trying to connect the sincere statements made by folks about the national and international environment with the project that we want to get done today or 2 years. There just seems to be such a wide chasm between that reality and, I think, the goal we'd all like to achieve.
I think we're done. Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.
And I'm sure this discussion will continue at some later date. September 25th, next meeting, 5:30, same time, same place. DA is first.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.